Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very honored to have as my guest Leonard Cohen, who has a new book of poetry, The Book of Longing, being published by HarperCollins. I'm very thrilled to be talking to Leonard, because when I arrived in college in 1969, the book, his novel, Beautiful Losers, had come out in paperback. It was required reading in many classes, and when you walked between the English department and the dormitory, you could hear the first or the second record being played on stereo speakers out the windows. I believe his work created part of the context of a very happy time. I, of course, have been listening to the records and reading the subsequent books of poetry, and this is the first time we've spoken together. The book seems, in particular, Book of Longing, to bring the reader close to what a poet's notebook looks like.
I think that's good.
That it's an authentic expression of what it is to lead a private life, to be drawing pictures, to be doodling, writing the beginnings of poems, seeing where they lead.
I think that's I myself, having undergone some kind of disintegration of the mind, have lost my capacity to concentrate for very long periods of time. So I enjoy notebooks and footnotes. I find myself reading footnotes rather than the text. So in a certain sense, this is a collection of footnotes.
I want to ask you what it was like to be a young poet. I know the very first book, Let Us Compare Mythologies, which was published 50 years ago, is having a facsimile edition published this year, and I've never heard about what the Canadian poetry scene was like.
Oh, it was and is a very, very vital enterprise. Montreal, at the time when I published, is the wrong word, printed Let Us Compare Mythologies, because that was the first book in the McGill poetry series, edited by Louis Dudek, but we just invented that, and I just collected some money and had the book printed. I think we had 400 copies printed, and that was the way we did things. But we had this, we ourselves had a sense of an extremely vital, important, significant enterprise. We all thought we were famous. We all thought we were geniuses. We all thought the world was listening, or was very soon about to listen.
I wondered, because the imagery is so vibrant and even violent, and the way the images are juxtaposed are too in your early work, what were the influences?
I read a lot of Lorca at the time, and a lot of Isaiah and apocalyptic religious literature appealed to me. The prayer book, the synagogue, labor movement, the singers like collectors like Alan Lomax, singers like Pete Seeger, the People's Songbook. The Almanac singers, all those were the influences. On the European side, the singers like Emilio Rodriguez and the flamenco singers, the fado singers, the French chanteurs, those were the influences.
Now, I was rereading Beautiful Losers, and its fire still singed me. You know, the apocalyptic nature of the writing and its vision, but it also struck me magnificently that a certain shape has maintained itself from then until now in the new book. There's an earthly woman, there's a teacher who may be sort of like Shrike in Miss Lonely Hearts. He may be a hectoring and spectacularly dangerous presence. And then there's a spiritual woman. And the movement between the earthly woman and the spirit of woman, mediated by the manipulations of earthiness and lust, that seems to be your constant theme.
If you put it that way, yes. I like that. Sure, that's good.
But do you think that most writers at a certain point discover the essential principle? Because here we have a career of writing and songs that really are variations within the sweatbox of that small combat of earth and heaven, of female and male.
I think it's a very legitimate view, not, and inspired, more than legitimate. It's one that I myself would steer away from, just because it is, to my mind, a fruitless activity, but a very legitimate activity for a reader. For the writer, I think it would be, in my case, first of all, I don't have the analytic equipment to really construct that viewpoint. But I think it's very, and I've just enjoyed hearing it from you.
You see, that is something I've always wondered about. It seems to me that we come with our themes and our concerns, in some sense, already installed, and that, you know, our lives are the working out of certain problems that precede us.
I think in the case of a writer, that the problem is survival, and you know, there are so many voices, you know, inviting you to sit down and shut up. There are so many obstacles and hazards in the activity itself, so that I think that anybody who is allowed to stay in it for the long haul, you know, develop certain strategies. Some of those strategies are very conscious. You know, some people say, "I'm not going to teach in the university," or "I am going to teach in the university, but I'm going to keep my, you know, door closed." So there are all kinds of strategies. In my case, I always felt I was on the front line of something that was tumultuous, and that I couldn't penetrate, and that I couldn't analyze. Once I surrendered to that condition and became somewhat comfortable in it, I was able to continue to work without an overview of either the significance or importance of the work.
In fact, it seems like that book and the rest of the work literally proceeds page by page. Some people say that their unit as a poet or a writer is the sentence or the verse, but this seems to be about arriving at the table to write and filling the page with an emotion that may be violent, provocative, difficult, infuriating, but to fill the space with that emotion, and then the next day, well, where will that take us?
I think that the content of that work at the moment of arrival at the page is exactly the strategy that allowed you to get there. Because getting there is the trick. Getting there is the trouble. Once you get there, once your life is organized so beautifully that you can actually, you know, there's a table and a chair and a typewriter, you know, that already is an incredible triumph. Now, most people give up. They can't, their minds are, I know they're much more fertile than mine because I speak to people whose minds are fertile but who can't write. You know, my mind is not particularly fertile. My only success is the fact that I've been able to get to the desk. So my whole life has been trying to arrange those moments when, you know, I can take care of everything that is not in that room and have the moment to arrive. And usually what I'm writing about is what I have had to do to get to the moment in front of the desk.
Now, over the years, it seems to me that the writing has become more and more and more intuitive. But at the time of Beautiful Losers, it seemed as if there was all sorts of reading in comparative religion and ethnicities. And I wondered if you would tell me about the person who was bringing that knowledge, that research, to the desk.
At that time, I was a reader and a passionate a reader of poetry. There were some collections of poetry, some softcover anthologies, and my friends would quiz me. I mean, they'd open up the book at any page and start a line or in the middle of the poem or at the beginning, and I could usually finish it. I knew the canon very, very well, and it was my life. I don't know what happened to my life since then. It changed considerably, and all the material and the hints and the concerns that I laid down in my first books, I eventually lived. I mean, I was interested in religion. I did become a monk. You know, I was interested in women. I did throw myself into a kind of blue movie for a number of years. So I was able to manifest in my real life a lot of the early concerns. Then something happened. I'm not sure what it was. And it all collapsed, and all the structures seemed to be useless. And I somehow, I don't know if it's accurate, but I somehow associated it with a general global collapse. I don't know whether that was just wishful thinking, or what professionals would call projection, but everything then collapsed, and then the work became about just showing up. What did I have to do to be able to show up to finish a song or to write a book?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with great pleasure to Leonard Cohen, author most recently of Book of Longing, which is published by Echo over at HarperCollins. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Leonard Cohen about his collection, Book of Longing. This is a very special year. There's also a documentary about the life of Leonard Cohen that is starting to appear in theaters, having been successfully admired in film festivals. This book, The Book of Longing, has been published. There are facsimiles of his earliest books being published. I wanted to ask you if you would read the first poem in the book. This is Leonard Cohen reading from Book of Longing. It's a poem called The Book of Longing.
I can't make the hills. The system is shot. I'm living on pills, for which I thank God. I followed the course from chaos to art. Desire the horse, depression the cart. I sailed like a swan, I sank like a rock. But time is long gone past my laughing stock. My page was too white, my ink was too thin. The day wouldn't write what the night penciled in. My animal howls, my angels upset. But I'm not allowed a trace of regret. For someone will use what I couldn't be. My heart will be hers impersonally. She'll step on the path, she'll see what I mean. My will cut in half and freedom between. For less than a second, our lives will collide. The endless suspended, the door open wide. Then she will be born to someone like you. What no one has done, she'll continue to do. I know she is coming. I know she will look. And that is the longing. And this is the book.
Leonard Cohen reading the first poem in Book of Longing. Now, when I read that, I thought of it as a kind of visionary poem. That in the same way, you'll pardon me, that Yeats imagines the rough beast slouching toward Bethlehem and said, when seeing Ubuwah in Paris, after us the savage god, he was anticipating the age of savagery, that this is a vision of a new way of being.
Yeah, well... For me, its beauty is that it's finished. I have my secret pleasures in the poem. I worked on a long time. I have maybe 50 verses. And maybe 10 different directions, and I was thinking of doing actually a whole record of all the verses, but this is a distillation that participated in a lot of my own preoccupations. For one thing, it is a reasonable explanation of what currently is called reincarnation. You know, I don't think we're reincarnated, and I'm afraid we're not. That's the good news. But I think that certain ganglia of impulses, you know, survive, and other entities are attracted to them, and that they can unfold things that were not completed, can unfold. And I want to be very, very vague about what it is. But, you know, someone will use what I couldn't be. Those unfulfilled, incomplete ambitions, desires, impulses, failures, they in somehow will enliven another spirit, and another spirit will take them, you know. So that's and I don't believe any of that, but that's a form, you know, for the music.
Well, what do you mean when you say you don't believe any of
that. Well, I mean to say, I wouldn't go to the, you know, if so, you know, if they said you're going to be burned at the stake unless you recant, you know, this heretic view of reincarnation, I would say, I repudiate it immediately. I'm not quite sure what I meant. And you know, I think your view is actually sounds a lot better.
No, but you see, I'm not a scholar. I'm a lover of literature, and I live through it. And when I sense in my bones, in my blood, you know, this sounds in this poem. Yeats has poems about the coming of Helen, who is to be the incitement of the Trojan War. This is a vision of a different kind, a more pacific kind of female spirit. And I know what you mean, that you're not saying on September 30th in the year we will witness an arrival. That's not what I mean. But there is a state of belief that is the writing state, and that generates the consistency of the poems.
No, I agree with you, and I like to hear you say it, but I don't want to equip my work with credentials. You know, I don't want to say anything about it. You know, what my secret feelings are by nature secret. I do have, you know, when I'm provoked or invited, you know, to think of the significance of anybody's activities, you know, and I rarely go to that place, but then I can develop certain feelings about where things are going and how they will react. But this little piece, I think, will just, you know, strike a little spark somewhere.
There's a poem that I absolutely love that is in the spirit of that kind of surrender and the miracle that something has been completed. It's a poem to a spider, and it's called Wish Me Luck. It's in the Book of Surrender on page 67.
Oh, I just opened that page.
Of course.
Wish me luck. A fresh spider web billowing like a spinnaker across the open window. And here he is, the little master, sailing by on a thread of milk. Wish me luck, Admiral. I haven't finished anything in a long time.
I love that. The acknowledgement of the spider for having completed the web when one hasn't been able to complete anything at all. It's really beautiful. And you're not really a poet of the external world. So in this book, it's really a very special poem.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, a friend of mine observed that I never wrote about nature.
At a certain point, the poetry seems not a creation of an artifact, but a way of life. And I wanted to ask about that transformation.
Well, I think that's true. I don't know much about poetry, and I was just reading a magazine that comes out of St. Mark's, the Poetry Project. I picked it up, and, you know, and I'm filled with admiration and even envy at the mind that is clearly manifesting in many of those pages. But it's very, very far from this activity, which, that's why I'm reluctant to call it poetry. I like your idea of footnotes or notes or some other kind of activity, because I think there is an enterprise called poetry today, you know, and I don't really feel part of it. But I admire it, and I know that I have connections to it, And I don't feel any necessity to disassociate myself from it. But I don't have that mind that seems to be valued today. I can't understand a lot of this of the stuff that is written, and that isn't because it isn't accessible. It's just because I don't have the equipment.
I wondered though, because running through the work. To my ear, there's the sound of Blake and the sound of the translators of testaments of the Bible. And it's certainly, while personal and daily and part of a diary of being, it seems to come from a belief in the poetic experience.
Well, the materials are certainly from. I mean, the tools are antique, and I'm happy, you know, because I can do so few things. You know, I'm happy that I was able to find a few tools and learn how to use them. And I think it's mostly in the area of finding one's self-respect and having something to do. I think unemployment is really the great problem of society on every level. You know, people feel unemployed. So I'm very, very happy that I don't, and that I found a few, you know, rickety old implements, and I've been able to use them. But they don't seem to be terribly valued these days. And when I read a lot of modern poetry, I feel that there's a deliberate intention not to use those old cast iron creamers.
I've been speaking with Leonard Cohen, author most recently of Book of Longing, published by Echo. Thank you, Leonard, for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've listened to you for years, and it's a great privilege to be here.
I'm similarly thrilled. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Book of Longing on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and more than 800 other Bookworm broadcasts can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.